Before we get into today's podcast, I want to offer you a powerful free resource. We often hear from listeners looking for answers to those who claim God cannot exist for a variety of scientific reasons. But science actually supports the existence of God, which is why I want to offer you a free download called God's Not Dead. It explores scientifically how our own cosmos points to a creator in three clear areas. Again, this powerful resource is yours absolutely free, so why not download God's Not Dead for free right now at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. Now, here's today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we're going to be talking about a story which has been very high profile here in the news in the UK, but I don't know how far it might have spread elsewhere in the world. But before we get into it, it is a story about medical malpractice, about a shocking scandal here in our national health system, which led to a lot of people, including young people, falling very ill and dying. So, yeah, it's going to be another slightly heavy episode, isn't it, Dad?
I'm afraid so. And it's very close to home for me because I spent many years working in medical research, including doing potentially very dangerous things to very sick babies, trying to find new ways of preventing brain damage. And also I then, as a professor of medical ethics, taught research ethics at UCL for many years and sat on an medical research ethics committees discussing the ethics of all kinds of medical research. So this story is deeply close to home and deeply tragic and troubling.
Hmm. And so the story we're talking about is often called the infected blood scandal. You'll correct me where I get this wrong, but my broad understanding as a kind of non-medical layperson is that for a period of time in the 1970s and 80s, the UK could not produce enough blood products for transfusion internally, and so imported both blood itself, but also some medical products derived from blood, and they imported them from the United States, where in many instances the blood had been contaminated by viruses, particularly HIV and hepatitis. And then these blood products were given to patients in the UK, especially patients with haemophilia, and caused a lot of them to then be infected unknowingly.
Yeah, and perhaps even to backtrack for that, we should talk about the Blood Transfusion Service here in the UK, which is an extraordinary phenomenon, almost unique. Initially in the way it was set up, in that it encouraged members of the public to volunteer without any kind of incentive at all to donate their blood. And so this is a very major institution in the UK of people who regularly donate blood, volunteers, of whom you're one.
Guilty as charged, yes. Do you know what? I first did it when I was a teenager in my gap year, because it is the quickest and easiest and free way to find out your blood type. And I needed to know my blood type. This is true. I needed to know my blood type because I was going overseas for a gap year project. And for some reason, the medical insurance needed my blood type. And I was like, well, I could either pay for a kind of private test, or if you go and sign up as a blood donor, you know, they tell you your blood type after your first donation. And completely having no interest or intention, I went once and I got hooked, and I've been giving blood approximately every 3 months as often as I'm able ever since. I think I'm up to 41 donations now.
Well, there you are, you see. And your entire payment for this is a cup of tea and a biscuit, isn't it?
Lots of free biscuits. Very generous, yeah. Custard creams, chocolate biscuits, bit of squash. Yeah, at the end they give you a little, they put out a little tray of goodies to, you know, ostensibly to replenish your, you know, you're feeling a bit woozy and weak. Though I've actually thankfully have never had any kind of bad reaction, so I just tuck in and take it as my payment and cycle home. But yes, it's all entirely run on altruism and goodwill,
and it's very British, isn't it? The whole way in which it sort of operates is a kind of, don't you think so?
Yeah, absolutely. Everyone's calling you love, and you know, cheery nurses, and it's all, you know, they often do these kind of mobile blood donation kind of units that move around. And so they'll set up, they're always in slightly odd places, like a school hall or the council building or, you know, some car park somewhere. And you have all these kind of cheerful middle class Brits rolling up their sleeves and squeezing balls, doing their bit. And then, you know, being given a little plaster and toddling off back to their normal lives. And it's kind of amazing that it works, that, you know, it provides enough blood for the entirety of the UK and all the medical treatment that happens every single day up and down the NHS. And it's and enough, you know, they have these big signs outside where they say, you know, 97% of us rely on the other 3% to give blood. Can you sign up? And they're always, you know, looking for new donors. And we don't have a crisis in blood. There isn't, like, we're not desperately having to import blood from elsewhere or, you know, even in catastrophes, there's always enough blood. So it's amazingly, there is enough generosity among the minority of us who donate to keep the rest of the country going.
That's right. I mean, my experience of this was when I was a junior doctor on the neonatal intensive care unit. At the time, it was believed that giving fresh blood transfusions to these babies who are very sick was sometimes the best thing to do. So the junior doctors were all screened by the blood transfusion service, and then when you needed to give a fresh blood transfusion, you were basically invited to sit down and roll up your sleeve. And so quite often after the very long shift, being up all night looking after poorly babies, the final coup was that I then had to sit and roll up my sleeve. And but at least because they were only babies, you didn't take a whole pint.
They took
50 mils was enough.
Yes, anyway. I've always been very proud. I was told once a few years ago that I saw that they were putting on my blood bag the little label with the word Neo on it. And I asked someone, what does Neo mean? And they said, oh, well, it means you're a very special donor, Mr. Wyatt. Your blood has been checked and is good enough and clean enough that we can give it to premature babies. And they told me that one blood bag, I think they take a pint, is it? Is enough to do, I think, 11 or something, or 11 transfusions for premature babies. And so they're like, every time you donate, you're saving the lives of 11 newborn babies, which I walked away on cloud nine thinking I was the best person ever. It was amazing.
That was worth the biscuit.
Absolutely.
So anyway, what has happened in the States was that blood donation is a commercial business. You get paid, although not very much, and therefore inevitably it's seen as a way of people earning a bit of money when they're destitute, and so the population of donors in the States inevitably has involved people often who are homeless, drug addicts, and so on,
prisoners, and sometimes they go into jail,
so therefore it's not surprising that it only became known really in the 1960s and 1970s that blood could carry infectious particles, viruses, which could then be transmitted through blood transfusion. But there was gradual awareness of that going on. And so taking products from America was known to carry a significantly increased risk of passing on some kinds of infections, particularly hepatitis, and as we now know, AIDS, the virus that caused AIDS, HIV.
Yeah. And so we fast forward to the 70s, and while the NHS's altruistic blood donation scheme is rattling away, there's this new thing comes on the market in the States, a few blood products called Factor 7 and Factor 8, I believe, which are particularly not for just regular blood transfusions, but these are for people who had haemophilia and they helped their blood clot again. Do you want to briefly explain what haemophilia is for those who don't know?
Yeah, so the blood clotting mechanisms are incredibly complex, and they involve a whole series of different clotting factors. And these clotting factors normally are circulating in the blood in small amounts. They're created by the liver, that they are required to produce stable blood clots. So if you damage yourself, you have a cut, all these blood factors are involved as a cascade, and it leads to a blood clot, which then stops the bleeding. And rare conditions, hemophilia is deficiency of one of these blood factors, a specific blood factor, factor 8. And I think it's factor 9 is the other one, something called Christmas disease. And people with this is a genetic condition passed on from parents, and children with hemophilia are at risk of having life-threatening hemorrhage. So even a relatively minor trauma, falling over in the playground, having an operation, even a minor operation, childbirth, all these things can lead to catastrophic and life-threatening hemorrhage. And so what was discovered is that if you took something called cryoprecipitate, which was just obtained from pooling blood transfusion products, whole blood that had been donated, the cryoprecipitate contained a whole bunch of clotting factors. And therefore, by giving cryoprecipitate to hemophiliacs after an injury, this would stop the bleeding and prevent a life-threatening hemorrhage. But then specific factors were starting to be identified, and in particular the factor 8 had been identified, but it was only available coming from the States. And so the doctors who were caring for children with hemophilia were interested in using this specific product from the States.
And so what we now know with the benefit of hindsight, as this lengthy public inquiry is revealing month by month, it is that despite the doctors knowing that the factor 8 and other blood products they were importing from the US was at least potentially contaminated, because as you say, they were pooling it together. So you only need one of your 20, 30, 50 blood donors to have HIV or hepatitis. But if it's all been pulled together, there are fragments of the virus present in everything that's produced from that pool. And they were importing this potentially contaminated blood and then giving it to British patients, particularly those who had hemophilia. And unsurprisingly, many of them, despite, you know, were not told about this and later developed these horrible, debilitating diseases, sometimes dying as a result.
Yes, and so the scandal sort of focuses in particular on one school, Treloar, which was intended as a school for children with medical problems, and it has a specialised place for children with haemophilia. And it was regarded, you know, as a national centre of excellence. This was the place. If your child had haemophilia, send them here, where they would receive specialist medical supervision. If they had an injury any time, day or night, the doctors were there, would provide treatment and so on. And tragically, the numbers are that of all the children with haemophilia who were cared for and looked after at Treloar over a period, a vast number died. You've got the numbers in front of you there.
Yeah, the scandal found that of the 122 pupils who had haemophilia at the school in the 1970s and 80s, only 30 were still alive today, which is just devastating, astonishing.
Yes, and what is so painful is that Treloar was seen as a potential centre for research into haemophilia, because you had such a concentration of children with haemophilia that it was an ideal place to undertake research trials of different methods of treating and preventing bleeds. And this is where the whole issue about medical research and the ethics of medical research sort of comes in. And as someone who's been on research ethics committees and taught about research ethics you know, this is something very close to me. So I think it would be quite interesting just to give a very potted history of medical research ethics. I mean, of course, medical ethics goes all the way back, even to the pre-Christian era, back to Hippocrates, and the idea that the doctor took a solemn and binding oath only to use their knowledge for the good of the patient and never to harm. But systemized medical research really only comes into prominence in the 20th century, and when doctors are starting to see that doing scientific research on patients, the idea, very basic idea of clinical trials, randomized trials, all these sort of things are starting to come into prominence. And and medical research in the early 20th century was seen as a very new, exciting, positive area, breakthroughs and so on. But then the horrific realities of what was happening in the Third Reich by the Nazi doctors came out. And this comes out in the Nuremberg trial immediately after the Second World War.
So what kind of things were the Nazis doing in concentration camps that kind of focus minds on how medical research can go so wrong?
Well, to be honest, it's so horrific. I don't really want to describe it detail.
If you're interested, if you have a morbid curiosity, you can Google it and find out this stuff online.
Really is horrific. But one of the very troubling things is that a lot of the experiments that were done in finding how people would die under certain circumstances. You know, these were concentration camp victims and so on. And yet the data, the research data that came out of some of those horrific experiments actually passed into general medical knowledge and has been used subsequently in the development of medical treatments and survival equipment and all kinds of things. And again, this is a very painful question about, you know, is it ethical even to use knowledge which has been obtained in deeply unethical ways? But if that, then you're using that knowledge to help other people not.
I mean, this takes us back many years to the whole COVID vaccine problem, you know, and the question of to what extent, if the vaccines were tested using cells that were originally potentially from an aborted fetus in the 1970s, you know, to what extent does that contaminate ethically the entire vaccine, and should Christians take it? Which, if you're interested, there are a series of episodes, if you scroll very far up this feed, delving into that question. So let's move on. So the Nuremberg trials kind of horrify the medical establishment, I hope, and it kind of prompts.
They absolutely did, and I think one of the very important things that horrified them was that the doctors who were doing this were not sort of disreputable, low status doctors. Many of them were, you know, professors in main elite universities in Germany and Austria. And this was supported. This was seen as, you know, elite medical practice. So therefore, this was a kind of huge wake-up call for the international medical community. And out of it came a series of principles which were enshrined in the Declaration of Helsinki, which has had various iterations. But one of the essential elements which came out, which goes all the way back to the Nuremberg trials, was that people who are involved in medical research must be volunteers. They must not be coerced, and they must be fully informed. They are participants. They're not just subjects
pawns.
Who you can abuse. Pawns, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, it's not the same as, you know, running rats through cages and things like this. You know, human subjects in research need to know what they're signing up for, be aware of the risks and the benefits, and have voluntarily chosen to take part.
So fundamental medical research principles were started to be internationally accepted and propagated. And then another scandal broke in the 1970s, which was to do with the US Public Health Service in a place called Tuskegee in southern US states, which where there had been a study going on since 1932, which was called the Tuskegee Study of Untreated Syphilis in the Negro Male.
Yeah, so this was where they gathered a group of black American men, half or kind of some of them had syphilis, some of them did not, and then basically without telling anyone involved and giving them any chance to understand what they were signing up for, basically tracked them over a long period of time to see how untreated syphilis kind of progressed in, for some reason, particularly black men.
That's right. And the irony is that it wasn't until 1972, this thing had been going on for over 30 years, without any of them receiving any treatment for syphilis. They were simply monitoring the progress of the disease. And it turned out, when it was sort of analysed, that all the men had agreed freely to be examined and treated, but none of them had been informed of the real purpose of the study. None of them being given the facts required to provide informed consent.
They were told they'd been treated for, quote, bad blood, which is a local term which doesn't really mean anything medically, of course. And most shockingly for me, during the course of this 40-year-long study, treatments for syphilis were discovered and employed elsewhere in the States, but were kind of deliberately withheld from those in the study.
That's right. And it was not until October 1972 that this official study was terminated. But ever since, Tuskegee has been seen as, again, one of those terrible examples of unethical medical research, demonstrating that it was happening in the USA, not just in Nazi Germany. Mm. I fear that Treloar is going to be added to this list of infamy as yet another tragic example of something that was happening in the 1970s and 1980s in a centre of excellence in the NHS.
Did you know that this month marks the 4th anniversary of Premier Insight, the ministry that brings you this podcast? While it's a real season of celebration, there's also a very real financial challenge that must be met this month. Due to rising costs and the pressure of inflation, there's a $35,000 gap that must be closed this month to keep Premier Insight moving forward with strength. So that's why I'm asking you to give a special anniversary gift to keep programs like this podcast on the air and equip a generation of Christians to live out their faith with clarity, conviction, and confidence. Simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
So talk to us about what a good medical trial might look like if these are bad ones. Like, what could they have done differently at Treloar that would have made it ethical?
Yeah, so the important thing ethically is, first of all, to make a distinction between where treatment has been approved, accepted, evidence-based, compared with treatment which is part of research. They're not the same things. So, you know, if you're diagnosed with bacterial pneumonia, and I say to you, all the evidence shows that giving you this injection of intravenous penicillin is going to treat your bacterial pneumonia, do you agree to that? You've still got to, you've got to give informed consent. But the fact that penicillin is far and away the best treatment for this is well known and accepted in medical science. But in a research trial, we're genuinely not sure what is the best treatment for your condition. And so the essential part of the research is that the interests of the individual subject should always take precedence over the interests of society as a whole. That's something which comes out of Nuremberg, and it's a kind of foundation of liberalism, isn't it? That the individual rights, individual, is more important than the interests of society as a whole.
Hmm. And I guess that's the great temptation always for scientists and researchers and doctors in this instance, is that they're so tantalized by the prospect of finding out information that could save thousands of lives in the future. It becomes very easy to minimize the individual handful of lives in the present that might have to be sacrificed or harmed. But think of the benefit, you know, think of the needs of the many should outweigh the needs of the few. You know, I guess that's always a temptation, always a pulling factor for scientists who have kind of grand ideas of coming up with a brand new treatment or something like that.
Well, it is. And, you know, the extraordinary thing, if you think about it, is that utilitarianism, which is, you know, the dominant ethical system in the secular West, rides a coach and horses through this.
Yeah.
Because utilitarianism says precisely that it is the sum of interests which matter much more than the individuals. And why on earth should you, within a utilitarian framework, protect the interests of an individual research subject when the benefit, potential benefit to thousands, hundreds of thousands of millions, is obvious?
Yeah. And the more kind of grimly honest and consistent utilitarian philosophers would quite openly say, you know, if I had to torture a baby to save a million lives, I would do it very gladly, and I would consider it to be an ethical act.
And
ordinary people kind of recoil from that, but that is entirely consistent if you believe that the way to judge what is a good act is about what causes the most benefit for the greatest number of people.
That's right. And so I think arguably it is Christian ethics, you know, the root of this concern for the individual.
Yes. Absolutely.
Emerges out of our Christian understanding that every individual is made in God's image. Every individual has unique value, significance, protection, and deserves protection.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make any sense at all within a utilitarian population perspective.
No. But Christianity says, you know, it's the 99 and the one, right? It says that even like God is so concerned by the one and by the fact that every one of his image bearers is precious and valuable, that it cannot be obliterated by the needs of a large number of others.
That's right. And so this respect for the individual means that we must engage their participation in research. That means I have to make sure you're fully informed, that you really understand why this research is important, including what the potential risks and benefits are to you. And also that research ethics says that the individual must have capacity. They must be in a position to make legally valid consent.
Mm.
And they must be completely uncoerced. There mustn't be either direct, you know, as in the Nazis, here is the machine gun pointed at you unless you agree. But similarly, they mustn't be soft coercion. Their consent must be entirely voluntary. And in particular, we should think how to protect people who are vulnerable to coercion or manipulation.
Mm. And I suppose in a modern kind of Western context, as you say, it's highly unlikely that anyone is going to be faced with kind of physical coercion to join a medical trial. But actually, these kind of soft factors are what those working in research need to be aware of, you know, a kind of subtle saying, you know, it would be really good for us as a hospital, as an NHS, if you were able to help us out by taking part, you know, or a fear that if I don't butter up the doctors, I might get worse treatment down the line, or, you know, potentially the expectation that I might get a lot of money if I take part. You know, that could start to twist people's ability to give freely given informed consent.
Absolutely right. And these are exactly the kind of issues which research ethics committees discuss. You know, I remember used to be discussions of, you know, you could be given some money to compensate for your expenses in taking part in this research trial, but there had to be a kind of limit, you know. So maybe we could offer you £100 for participation you know, but we certainly couldn't offer you £1,000 or £10,000, or that would become coercive.
Hmm. Even though some of these drug trials lead to the pharmaceutical companies making billions of pounds of profits in the end.
Exactly. And again, you know, all these kinds of issues that are being discussed. But going back to Trelaw, one of the most painful things, you know, reading the first person accounts from both from the children themselves and from parents, is the way that the doctors were so trusted.
So
one account says, "I'm from a good, upstanding, traditional Indian Sikh family. My parents trusted my doctors implicitly, and our doctor could do no wrong in our eyes." You know, someone else said, "It did not occur to us to question the doctors and how best they felt I should be treated. We took it for granted that the factor VIII products had been properly screened and were safe to use. Like any other reasonable family, we placed utmost faith in the doctors."
Yeah. And I understand that, you know. I mean, I've had it itself, you know, where taking our daughter to the hospital and you listen carefully to what the doctors say, and it sounds reasonable, and I don't know anything about this, I'm not medically trained, and they seem nice, and you say, well, yeah, I presume everything is above board, and they've thought through all the possible risks, and they're only doing this in the best interest of my child, and you entrust them into their care. And, like, it's that kind of medical deference we talked about before in the podcast that's just kind of baked into a lot of our interactions, is you're the expert, I'm ignorant, you're a good person because only good people go into medicine, so I can just do what you say.
Yeah, and you know, when you train as a doctor and start work in clinical practice, it's something that every clinician discovers. Particularly it was the case, you know, I qualified in 1979, and I can remember the attitudes then. You know, you were just aware of the extraordinary power you had. You know, in those days we wore white coats, and when the white coat came to the bedside and took your hand and said, you know, basically, "Well, doctor, whatever you think, you know, that's, I'm sure whatever you say, I'll have it." And therefore there's an extraordinary responsibility being placed on the clinician, and particularly in that previous era where it was an era of medical paternalism. You know, and literally paternalism is about a doctor-child relationship, isn't it?
The doctor is the father and you are the little
parent-child. Yeah. And so, you know, I'm the daddy, you're the little child, and trust me, you know, you can trust daddy. Daddy knows best.
Yeah.
Daddy will always do what's, and even if daddy's doing something rather strange, you know, just trust daddy. And that was the kind of medical paternalism in which the whole medical profession was raised. And this scandal goes back to that 70s era. And yet what's clear is the doctors did know there were risks. They did know that particularly the samples coming from the States carried increased risk. And other doctors elsewhere in the country were therefore not using these American products.
And that's what I find so troubling about this is, you know, Tuskegee and Nuremberg are horrifying, chilling accounts, but they feel very distant. They feel in a different era, a different generation of time. But the 1970s and 80s are not that far away. You know, very shortly before I was born, these were people who were not, you know, Nazi monsters or, you know, racist Southern kind of white men in the 1930s America. These were, you know, good, upstanding, middle-class citizens who'd gone into pediatrics because they wanted to help sick children and thought they were doing the best thing. And yet they recklessly, willfully infected children without their any consent with contaminated blood. It's very hard to wrap your head around how that could happen so recently into the 1980s.
It is, and it's why this story is so painful, I think, particularly to people like me in the medical profession. I think one of the unconscionable things is that the doctors concerned, some of whom are still alive, have refused to give evidence, have refused to say anything. Some of them living abroad can't be compelled legally. And so there's not even the possibility for the parents and the children, now grown up, to hear what the doctor's own thinking was or any kind of justification. Instead, there's just a blank wall.
Yeah. I mean, you were literally working in the NHS in this era. You were being trained in the 70s, working in the 80s. Some of these people will be in the kind of cohort of paediatricians that you were working alongside. Does it seem hard for you to understand, or does it feel actually attitudes were incredibly paternalistic at the time?
No, I think it is, you know, looking back now, it's almost impossible to comprehend the revolution in attitudes since the 1970s. Just as an illustration, I think we've mentioned this before, but in the topic of abortion, if you look at the Abortion Act, which came in 1967, the decision about whether or not an abortion should be carried out is entirely framed in terms of medical paternalism. There's nothing about the consent of the woman. There's nothing about her choice. It is simply that two doctors in good faith believe that the carrying out an abortion will produce less harm than allowing the pregnancy to carry on. And certainly, you know, when I reread a book written by a Christian gynecologist about the issue of abortion, this book was written in the 1970s, and it says, you know, this is clearly a deep, difficult question. Who can make a decision as to about whether to carry out an abortion? And then it said, clearly the woman herself, intoxicated as she is by the hormones of pregnancy, is in no fit position to make any kind of decision about her own pregnancy. You know, and you read those words 40, 50 years later, and you cannot believe that those were the attitudes, but actually they were. It was this paternalism. The woman is a child. She's not able to make a rational decision about whether to have an abortion or not. It's for the grown-ups in the room to take this kind of decision. And it's not really, I think the revolution really takes place from the 1980s, when the rise in the understanding of patient autonomy, autonomy becomes a principle in bioethics, of teaching about informed consent. So it took a long time, I think, for these fundamental principles, which were fleshed out after the Nazis, to actually be instilled in the everyday practice of medicine.
I mean, I remember reading accounts and hearing stories from family members about how in this era it was still commonplace for people who had been diagnosed with some quite nasty diseases, cancer in particular, just to not be told, to be lied to and said, oh, you've got something else, don't worry about it, we're looking after it, when actually the doctors knew they had a terminal form of cancer at which there was no kind of treatment. And so in that context, it perhaps shouldn't surprise us that those same doctors were effectively experimenting on young children with haemophilia without telling them.
Now, I remember that from my time as a junior doctor, that where you sometimes found these bizarre situations where the patient who was clearly had something horrible and terminal had been told, don't worry, it's just a little ulcer and we're going to provide a treatment and everything's been fine. The doctor then tells the relatives, or may tell the relatives, actually it's cancer, but you mustn't tell the patient because that would be terribly bad for him. Then you go and talk to the patient and the patient says, well, I've worked out that it's cancer, doctor, but don't tell the relatives because it would be terrible if they knew that I was dying. And so I'm pretending it's just an ulcer and I'm going to get better. And so you've got this bizarre kind of charade going on where nobody could be honest. And yet, you know, that was commonplace. That was a way of dealing with these catastrophic realities.
And from the present day, I would say that ties in not just in the kind of medical paternalism, but it also ties into a basic kind of emotional repression in British culture, which is that people didn't often have very easy language and ways to talk about difficult, painful things, and they had been raised, told to keep a stiff upper lip and to soldier on, and the good British thing to do was just to not think about it too much and just briskly move on. And, you know, people would literally die without properly addressing the fact with their loved ones that they are about to die.
Yes, I think it certainly was part of that British stiff upper lip. I think to be fair, it was Anglo-Saxon. I think you would find exactly the same in the Anglo-Saxon world across the world. It was part of that understanding of what it meant to be strong, to be a man. And again, I think one of the other revolutions we're unaware of is the kind of psychologization of our own self-understanding, understanding about emotions, about memories, about trauma, about, you know, all these things are now commonplace to us. But, you know, you go back to the 1980s, I think of my parents, that whole, they were intelligent, well-educated people, but talking about this kind of psychologization of trauma and depression and mental health and everything else, this would have seemed completely foreign language to them, inappropriate.
Yeah. And I suppose, you know, one thing I'm kind of thankful for as a non-medical person is that there has been this kind of sea change and you know, paternalism is increasingly identified and kind of stigmatized among doctors. There's been, you know, that the kind of doctors have been knocked off their demigod pedestals and have come down to join us mere mortals on the ground.
Yes. I mean, although it's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, again, the human condition, it often seems to me that we're now gone to the reverse problem in the medical profession, because many people have expressed to me the frustration they've had. They go to see a doctor about some problem, and the doctor discusses various options, sophisticated, technical, difficult, you know, various possibilities, and then says, well, you know, what would you like me to do? And, you know, because the modern medical student is now schooled in the fact that patient choice is absolutely central.
And how can I treat you today?
And you know, I mustn't in any way say what I would do if I was in your position, because that would be abusing your autonomy. I must give you complete freedom, which, you know, I as a clinician was often asked the question, you know, okay, doctor, these are the possibilities. What would you do if it was you? What would you do if this was your baby? And I was always very happy to tell them, give them the answer, because it seemed to me that was exactly the right question. And I gave them my honest advice. But I would say, but in the end, it's your decision. You choose. But my advice would be, this is the best choice.
Yeah. And that's what I appreciate when we've, you know, had as parents to deal with medical professionals is you want, obviously you want them to be framed in, it is your choice, it's your child, it's your consent required. But I want to know, you're the doctor who sees this particular condition week in, week out. You're the doctor who's done thousands of this type of surgery. I want to know you as an expert. How would you proceed? What is your recommendation? Then I'll take that under consideration when I make my decision. You've talked before about the vision, you know, we don't want medical paternalism. We don't want to reify the patient in their ignorance. We want it to be structured around the idea of an expert-expert relationship, in which the pediatrician and the doctor isn't clearly an expert. The parent is an expert in their own child, and they collaborate together to coalesce a consensus around the best treatment course for the child.
Yeah, it's obviously idealistic, and it depends on a lot of variables to achieve that kind of expert-expert relationship. But it does seem to me that is the best model. And again, you know, from a biblical Christian theological point of view, again, you can see the basis for that, because that expert-expert model takes account of the expertise of the doctor, the time, the energy, the training, the experience that they've had, but it also recognizes and values the expertise of the patient and the family as human beings made by God of with their own history and culture and perspective and concerns. And that foundational attitude of respect, it seems to me, is central to Christian medical ethics.
And when I reflect on this whole story of infected blood and medical ethics scandals, medical research scandals as a Christian, the thing that particularly troubles me is, as I said before, it's easy to write off the Nazi doctors in concentration camps or the Tuskegee public health officials. But the people who were injecting, you know, what we now know was contaminated factor VIII into haemophiliac children in the 1980s, these were people who were unquestionably, you know, thought themselves as the good guys. You know, they probably went into pediatrics with really good intentions, hoping to help kind of deeply sick children. And yet somehow they did incalculable harm and ended up killing people. Hmm. Like, how do we make sense of that from a spiritual perspective? How do we make sense of that as Christians, that people who thought they were doing such good, who in the eyes from the outside looked like really good people, ended up being causing huge evil?
Yeah, and I think, you know, this is the category of the well-meaning fool. And it's interesting, isn't it, that, you know, the saw the road to hell is paved by good intentions, in Christian thinking, being well-meaning doesn't protect you from catastrophe or causing catastrophe to others. And the biblical answer to that, the Old Testament answer to it, is wisdom. Mm. And it's the fear of the Lord that is the beginning of wisdom. But it's then using wisdom, using all the information, using understanding of the natural order. But also, I think, it's interesting, isn't it, that a key factor of godly wisdom is listening to other people. It's not going it alone. You know, there are several proverbs that talk about the importance of friends, the importance of counselors, seeking advice.
Iron sharpening iron.
Yeah, and so on. So, in retrospect, if the doctors at Treloar had really listened to other colleagues, had discussed with them, had taken advice, they could have been protected. Instead, there seemed to be this kind of almost a willful blindness, a desire to just do their own thing. They were so convinced they were right. Hmm. They were not prepared to listen.
And there's something about the fundamental posture of Christian wisdom which forces us to be humble, to act in humility, yeah, because wisdom is, as we clearly see in scripture, is a gift from God. You know, you see that, you know, when Solomon is asked, you know, what do you want? And he asks for wisdom. It's a gift from God. Sometimes wisdom is even personified in some of the Proverbs, you know, as a kind of person. But it's sometimes linked with Jesus. And there's this idea that therefore that if wisdom comes from beyond us, we can't be puffed up and reliant on our qualifications and our expertise and us being good people and clever people. It's fundamentally something we have to receive as a gift. And therefore, it has to be exercised with humility and graciousness and care and caution, because it's not our thing to wield as a weapon. It's not something that I've built up wisdom in myself, though obviously I do believe that you can kind of become wiser over time, but it's something that has to be acted out of a posture of humility.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's fascinating to me that humility was not a virtue within the classical Greco-Roman world. In fact, it was seen as a deficit. As a lack, you know, it was the powerful, the masterful, the confident, and humility was seen as something to do with women and of little account. But in Christian thinking, Christianity took most of the virtues which Aristotle and the classical Greeks had already identified, but added humility as being an essential part because of this Christian understanding. Mm. And it is interesting that even in secular thinking today, the phrase that now is often used is epistemic humility, you know, recognizing that you might be wrong, recognizing that the thing you thought was correct.
Yeah. Don't hold on too tightly to your grand theories.
Yeah. So you're absolutely right. Humility is an essential property. It's sadly rather lacking in many doctors. You know, I often think that medical arrogance is a kind of besetting sin of the medical profession. And yet that humility that thinks I might have got it wrong, I want to check, I want to listen to other people, is an essential part of wisdom.
And you can see in the New Testament how the early church centered on humility. You know, you see that famous, what people many think Paul is quoting, a kind of early Christian hymn I think it's Philippians, where he, you know, he writes about, you know, Jesus, although he was made in the very image of, likeness of God, did not consider equality or something to be grasped, but emptied himself and gave himself up on the cross. And you can see how a community that was gathered around, you know, a weekly remembrance of Jesus dying on the cross clearly had to be a community marked by humility, because the founder, the Lord, the King that they worshipped the ultimate instigating act of this church was the greatest act of humility ever seen. You know, Christ coming to earth, laying aside his glory as the second person of the Godhead and being killed by those he had created.
It's the ultimate paradox, isn't it? The profound paradox at the heart of Christianity, that the God of total power and authority empties himself. It's, you know, that Greek word kenosis. Mm. And it's what makes Christianity so different from all the other religions, the world religions, is at its heart is that kenosis, that self-emptying. Tragically, Christians have very frequently failed to live out the paradox at the heart of their faith.
Yeah, and the cross, you know, which is adopted as this kind of almost satirical symbol by the early Christians. You know, why would you take on the symbol of the Roman execution machine as the symbol of your faith? And it's kind of almost pointing to the fact that this is a community gathered around humility and in sacrifice is fullness. And that cross has sadly, over 2,000 years of Christendom, become a kind of symbol of, in many ways, power and oppression in the state, and, you know, crusaders on their shields and numerous other ways. And it is, yeah, beholden on us as believers to kind of constantly be challenging and checking and questioning ourselves, you know, whether you're a doctor, but whatever kind of power you hold, you know, how are you operating in this power with humility? How are you ensuring that it's being exercised in a kind of cross-shaped fashion?
Yeah, profound stuff, Tim.
Well, I think we should probably call it quits there. Thanks, everyone, for listening. I hope you found that useful, helpful discussion. As always, we're really interested in your own thoughts, so please do email in, molad@premier.org.uk. If you've taken part in a medical trial, if you've been involved in the healthcare professions, what are your own thoughts on these really important, challenging ethical issues about paternalism and deference and consent and autonomy and all these other things that we've been talking about. And there's lots more to read and watch and listen to on Dad's website on these kind of medical ethics subjects. So do look at that if you haven't already. That's johnwyatt.com. You always tell me I should plug my own stuff as well. So I have a website, tswyatt.com, with lots of my journalism on there, including links to my weekly church news Substack newsletter, The Critical Friend, which you can sign up to for free, tswyatt.substack.com. That's enough promotion. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.